Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. When I lived in New York City, one of my favorite things to do was go see stand-up comedy. I saw today's guest one night and she blew me away, and I couldn't be more honored that she came on my podcast. The incredible Bonnie McFarlane has been performing and writing comedy for decades. She's funny, she's smart, she's sweet, she's gorgeous, and I'm so lucky I get to call her my friend. We talk about her book, her documentary, her podcast. Honestly, what doesn't she do? She opens up about her friendship with Anthony Bourdain and tells us which comedian she thinks is on the rise. If you've ever wondered what it takes to be a comedian, you're going to hear it now. Sit back, relax, and listen to Bonnie McFarlane. Like an honor and a pleasure.
Honor to be here, Rachel. Your guests are so huge. I can't believe you have me on.
Oh my gosh, come on. So we met through our mutual friend and comedian, Sherrod Small. And when I saw you on stage, I thought you and your husband, who had also been performing that night, were so good. And I just felt like I was sitting with the biggest celebrity when I got to hang out with you after. And it was just so fun for me. So it's really, I'm just so excited to be talking to you. And you had told me that night about your book. I went home, I went on Amazon, I ordered it. And when I moved down to Florida, I had started it, but then when I moved down to Florida, I was like, wait a minute. I brought very little things with me, and I brought your book, and I went through it so quickly, and I thought it was just amazing. So
thank you so much. That's like so thrilling. When you sent me that picture of you reading it, I was like, oh, this is so great.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a question from reading your book, though. So right off the bat, you start talking about your childhood and how kind of awful it was in Canada, and how you had no running water, no electricity for a while, and you had to, hang out with cows and all this stuff. So is that real, or was that because you're?
Oh, no, it's all real. It's so weird, Rachel, because it feels like it happened to somebody else. Like, you know, look at me. I mean, I'm like living normal life now, you know, but it, and at the time I really felt like I'd been born into the wrong family. Like this wasn't supposed to be happening to me, you know, but when looking back on it, I go, what a gift that I got, you know. Nobody ever gets to, very few people get to grow up like that. Like in a, you know, it was just like back to nature, man. It was like camping all the time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so I'm curious, did people think you were funny as a child? Did your parents actually think you were going to be a comedian?
Well, I don't know about that. My mom did tell me one time that I should write advertising because the ads on TV weren't very funny and I was funnier than that. So, I mean, maybe they didn't have an idea of what was possible for someone like me. I was always funny. We didn't have we didn't even get television until I don't even know how old I was when we got television. And it was so random, like when we would actually get like a TV channel, you know, because we were so rural. And this is like before people had like, you know, there just wasn't any cable or anything out there. There's just nothing. So sometimes we could get a channel. Sometimes we'd get the French channel. It came in much clearer. We're in Canada, and we'd watch that, and we didn't know French, but so it was like everything was like open and accessible, and like you could make fun of things, and you didn't know what. I remember seeing like Monty Python for the first time and just being blown away, just being like, what is this? This is so amazing, you know.
So it wasn't like you had people that you were enamored with as a child. You just, that was innate in you, like your humor, your way of looking at things must have been different and something you were born with.
Yeah, I guess so. There were so many chores. We had 10 acres of garden. We had cows, we had chickens. And so there was so much like work to do without podcasts that you just were in your own head thinking about stuff. And I was writing funny stories all the time. And like coming up with funny scenarios or little jokes. Or one time for Christmas, I got a like a hand puppet, and so then I would do these, you know, concerts or whatever, with these shows where I family with these puppets and stuff. And no, it's just always really like thinking about jokes, although I didn't think of them as jokes at the time, but these little like funny scenarios. And my dad really got a kick out of me, so that was fun to like make him laugh. And yeah, I went, like, my mom would always be like, you take it too far. Like, it always ended in some kind of fight, you know. But I don't know.
Right. You were the first with cancel culture up there, I guess, with your family, which we'll get to later.
Yeah, that's so funny. Exactly. So
tell everybody how that translated to you actually deciding, I mean, this is jumping forward, but that you wanted to be a comedian and you wanted to try stand-up. Bring us
I wanted to be a writer because I remember the first time I wrote a scene of my family with my family characters, and I wrote, and it made me laugh so hard, this little scene that I wrote. And my dad came into my room and he was like, what are you laughing at? And I was like, nothing. But I don't know why I captured my family so perfectly, but just slightly heightened, that it really made me laugh. So then I was like pretty sure from that moment on that I wanted to be a writer. Like, that was a good experience. And then I just, I moved to Vancouver, and I was just sort of like flailing around and thinking like, I'm going to write a novel or something. I'm going to try to write something. And I was working in advertising at the time. I'd taken my mom's advice, I guess, and was writing these freelance advertising, which was not like exciting to me. And then I found stand-up and I was like, oh, okay, this is what I'm meant to be writing. So then I thought, I'll write comedy for people. And everyone was like, that's, you know, we're Canadian comics. We're not paying anyone for jokes. It just wasn't a good business model.
Right.
So, yeah, everyone that was really cool and nice and just kept convincing me to do it. And I was kind of shy. I didn't think I wanted to be in the spotlight at all.
Right.
And, but then I just started doing it.
And what was the first time you ever did stand up? What was that like?
So that was really scary, but I did very, very well. And the first little while that I did stand up, I had this weird thing in my head where I pretend in my own head I was a famous comic so that I could get on stage and do it. But it's like a weird thing that happens. It's like you're tricking the audience or something. Cause I would get standing ovations and stuff. Like,
wow.
It's like, I remember a comic going, that's not supposed to happen. He was like, you're an opener. But yeah, it was like for a while I would bomb and stuff, but I got so much work. I was just, and I would get like these, I mean, it was Canada, but I won a contest and get these little Canadian TV spots and stuff. And then I was like, oh, I'll just move to the States. And
so, but I think for people that like are afraid of talking in public, they can't even imagine what that is like to have to get in front of an audience, try out your material that maybe you've had in your head for a while. So like, what was that like to go up there, do so well? And then I'm assuming sometimes you were, as you said, bombing.
Well, the second time I really didn't do well at all, but then I sort of got back on track. But yeah, I bombed a lot.
Is it addictive or?
It's really, really addictive. Like I think if I didn't do well that first time, I probably would have never done it again.
Right.
But then you're just always chasing the dragon. It's so like, you get so worked up for it, you know, you're like, and then at some point the adrenaline and the nerves and everything, they get so much that you just go, you just have to put it aside. You just have to be like, I mean, I'm in this, I'm like going on, they're calling my name. I have to go out. Like there's, you know, you just get to this point where you're just kind of like, I don't care. Like, kill me. I'll right. just go do it. And then when it goes well, it's like a roller coaster, you know, you're like so scared and then it's so fun. Mm-hmm. And then when you get off, you're just like, I got to do it again. Here we go.
And how would you characterize your kind of comedy?
I guess I like to talk about my real life, but sort of hooked into like a bigger sort of subset of societal ills, you know, and then, I don't know. It's like, it's, I don't know. It's so hard to describe. So what do you think it is?
Well, I mean, for you, when I watch you, it's like very dry humor. Do you know what I mean? Like, right. I don't even know if I'm saying this right, but to me, you seem very calm, cool, and collect, kind of dry. You don't really know until you know you, you know, you don't really know where you're going with it, but it's so funny. You get so many laughs, but right. You're very kind of monotone a little
bit. Well, I think it's amazing sometimes. I know this sounds like a brag maybe, but I think I can't, sometimes I say things on stage and they get a big laugh and I can't even believe it. Like, cause I haven't like put any, like you said, like there's not a lot of inflection. Right. Well, sometimes I do. It depends. It's like, but I love it when I can be really dry and they get it. It's like, right. There's some kind of like,
well, that's part of the humor, I think. Cause that's, it's very funny when you say it like that. So for people that don't know you, would you say that for you and for comics, when you see a version of someone on stage, does that typically, is that part of who they are? Or do you think comics are completely different on stage than off?
No, no. I mean, I know some comedians who are completely different on stage and off. But I would say for the most part, comedians are, that's who they are, with a slightly heightened or performance value kind of thing going on. But for me, what I try to do, like what I, my goal always is to just be exactly like I am now on stage, but telling jokes. Like I just want to get to the actual core essence of being me on stage.
Right, right, right. And do you think that for someone to be a comedian, they have to have gone through some sort of trauma or molestation or something really awful in their childhood to be able to get up there and talk about it? Helps.
It helps. Well, you know why it helps? It's not really for the comedy, because I think lots of people can be funny. It's that whole thing of like where it's hard. It's not hard work in terms of like, yeah, you sleep all day and you only have to work like an hour a night or whatever, but it's hard in that there are so many times where you get on stage and it's like 300 people don't like you. And, you know, then you have to go back and do it, you know, sometimes an hour later, you're back doing it again, you know, or you're like, so there has to be some kind of like toughness in you. You've had to have some kind of challenge in order to, you know, like people can be mean. I've had sets where people are like, literally like, you know, you're not funny. Like get off the stage. And you're like, well, I'm legally obligated to finish my set. Sorry. You know? And so
have
yeah,
you ever,
I think
you've
had help to have some hardship in your life to be a good.
Right. Yeah. Have you ever come off the stage really depressed or really feeling like has anything really backfired? Like I know you've done Jimmy Fallon, you've done some really big shows. Like, has there ever been a time that you have really not done how you thought you were going to do and it really shocked you and affected you?
Oh, many times. Yes. All the time. I think I'm a genius. I like drive to fucking stand up. Like this is the greatest joke that's ever been thought of. And then I got on stage and it's just like, you're like, oh, you know, you're just like,
right.
What happened? Why didn't it go the way it did in my head? No, but I think that's like a sign of a comic. It's like, you're always, it's like, you're too full of yourself with too low self-esteem. It's right. Like, you're living these two double things all the time, you know? But yeah, I've definitely had shows where I go on stage and then it's just like, where I've cried in my car. It's so funny. I had a, this female opener one time and she opened for me and she didn't do very well. And then she was crying and the MC had gone back on stage, you know? So I'm, you know, trying to make her feel better about her set while they're, you know, introducing me. And then I got to go up. And then I told my husband that, Rich Voss, legend. And he said, he goes, I can honestly say that would not happen with men. I was like, maybe you're right. Like, would a man ever be like, it's so, right. you're hot and they're jealous. I got to go.
Right. The consoling part would just never happen. Yeah, exactly.
Crying after a show or something. No, that's like all, that's all female, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's why guys are like, I think like, it's not that guys are funnier than women, but they're just better kind of at not caring what people think.
Right, right. So in 2014, that brings up the fact that you did a documentary. It was called Women Aren't Funny.
Yes. And
you had some of the biggest male and female comics on there talking about whether or not they thought women were funny and the stigma of women in comedy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I had just had a baby I was touring, but then my daughter turned two. So then I had to start buying a flight for her. And I was like, fuck this, you know? And so I was getting tired of being on the road. So I thought I would do a different project. So I tried to think of it, something that people would want to talk about, you know, something that I could like get some juice on. And so people always want to talk about if women are funny or not. So I didn't really go in thinking like, I'm going to prove something here. I just thought it could be a funny topic that people could be funny about and wanted to talk about. But I kind of got sucked into it too. Like I was suddenly like, wow, people really don't think women are funny. Like,
yeah.
Depressing.
Right. It seems like that became the butt of the joke, kind of. Like that was really, men were like, yeah, none of you are funny.
I mean, people that I liked, I'd be like, can you think of any funny women? And they'd be like, not really. And you're like, hello, like I'm right in front of you. But it was like there was comedians that I really looked up, because I always thought they were joking around, like busting your balls, and they're like, women aren't funny, you know, like Sherrod would do. But obviously things.
But also there's a very small pool of like, when you hear of comedians, I mean, you can name so many men and just a few women, but do you think that's because so few women are going out for that? They're trying to make their life career be in comedy, or do you think that it's just much harder for them? Like, what is it like to be a woman in comedy?
Yeah, I think it's like, I think it's like a perfect storm of everything. It's like, you know, first of all, like women, you know, it starts early. Like you're not rewarded for being funny, generally speaking. Like I was like, no, but we didn't have any other entertainment. They were like, Bonnie, do something, you know? So I was like, you know, really rewarded for it from an early age. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of, like I, you know, even I see, you know, you have a daughter that's similar age. I think she's 16, right? So my daughter, her friends are so funny, you know, they don't even know they're being funny. Like, nobody goes, oh my God, this is like hilarious. You know what I mean? It's like, they're not rewarded for that. In fact, I saw one mom saying, stop, don't, you know, you're like, why would you shut that down? You know, but, and then when you get into it, it's like, it's just, it's kind of hard to network in the same way that men get to network, you know, cause you got to kind of a little bit, be careful of men's feelings because they think you're hitting them up for reasons other than just getting stage time. You know what I mean? Like if Mark Norman asks Joe List to get a set, they're like, yeah, sure. You know, but if a woman asks a guy, it's like, suddenly there's other factors at play, and it's not right or wrong. It just is what it is, you know? Right. And then, so that makes it a little bit tricky sometimes being, you know, wanting to be famous is like kind of seen as something sort of ugly in women. And then when you go on the road, it's, you know, a lot of the clubs are really like set up for men. It's been curated for a male audience. And so you have to work hard to, you know, I mean, this club owner told me one time that they go, who's on? And then if they just say any female name, they'd be like, who's the next guy you got on? You know?
Wow.
I know. You're like, really? So, which is fine. It's like, you know, there's certain comedians that if I hear it coming through, I'm like not interested in going to see either. It's just that they don't make it that easy for audience. Do you know what I mean? Like an audience that might want to come see a woman, they're not on the newsletter or whatever. They're not like being promoted to in that
right.
way.
But do you think it's like the stigma that women comedians are like only talking about getting their period or about their kids or breastfeeding? I mean, do you think it has something to do with that? Or,
well, that's just saying exactly what we're just talking about, which is that that's a male dominated audience. So men are like, no, I don't want to hear about your period. In fact, they don't want to hear about anything about women really. Cause they don't have to. They can go see a male comedian that's only talking about stuff that they like talking about. Right. And so, but of course, if you're being hilarious about getting your period and I'm in the audience, I mean, my friend Annie Letterman has a joke about, like, she goes, men hate stuff about the, you know, hearing about women's periods. She goes, they don't even know about the diarrhea. And it's like, so funny to me. I mean, any guy would be like grossed out, like, right, that's terrible, you know, but it's not for them, you know, right. Every joke doesn't have to be for every fucking person, you know? So it's just that thing of like, where that's just men saying what they like, but they're framing it as not funny or funny, but it's like, really, the quiet part is to me, you yeah. know what I mean?
Right, so right, right.
Not saying that out loud, but then it's like, because, and right now there's so much, that's the thing about the internet that sort of really helped people other than, it's helped white men also, but it's, you know, people who are not maybe typically wouldn't do well on the road are now finding audiences because they have a way to promote without the club, you know?
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Right. Meaning they could put out clips of segments, yes, whatever, and get people interested. I mean, I definitely have noticed new comedians that I follow now because of their clips on social, right, media, and same. I would have never paid attention to who they were.
Right, before. And they might not have ever gotten attention or gotten good because it's like you need stage time to get good. You need attention to get audience. It's like these two things kind of like go hand in hand. And if it's a guy club owner, you know, he probably likes a certain kind of man better than a certain kind of woman just because it's more relatable to him, which is fine. He's allowed to have what he likes and what he doesn't like. But, you know, in the big picture, that does slow down the thing about, you know,
right,
women getting ahead. And then the last piece of the puzzle is that, you know, really 10, 12 years in, that's when you really start sort of getting steam in stand-up. It takes kind of a while. And if you want to become like Andrew Schultz probably has been doing it 12, 14 years. It's like right around that time, that's when women are like, uh-oh, you know, I have this biological clock ticking.
Right.
And yeah. So for me, when I had my baby, it was like, that was one of the things that I had to figure out. Like, what am I like? Am I going to go on the road still? Am I going to just hire a nanny, never see my kid? Or am I going to figure something else out? Which I just was lucky because I like writing and I, you know, I enjoyed not being on the road. So
yeah, right. So you know both sides because, as you mentioned, you are married to a male comic, Rich Voss, and so he's very funny and we all know him. But tell everybody your love story, how you guys met, because I think it's so fantastic. Do you guys still call it a love story anymore? By the way.
We discussed the other night that we're both falling in love finally after all this time. We're just starting to really like each other. No, he's a hard person to love. Like, you've met him, right? He's like,
but I love him, but I don't have to live with him.
Exactly.
I just get to laugh with him. So that's
That is his saving grace, is that he makes me laugh all the time. So, So he was on a show called Last Comic Standing, and I had met all the people on that show except for him. I didn't know who he was. And one night I was at the Comedy Cellar, and I said to somebody, who's going on? And they said, oh, Rich Voss is on next. And I was like, oh, I haven't met him. So I went down the stairs, and he was standing at the bottom of the stairs waiting to go on. And he said, oh, you're that comic girl, which really like actually felt good that he knew that I was a comedian. Right. And he recognized me. And then he goes, so I talked to him at the bottom of the stairs for a minute. And then he goes, I'd hit on you right now, but I'm on a date. And then he showed me the girl. He was like, she was in the showroom. He showed her to me.
Right.
And a very attractive woman. And then he went on stage and kind of bombed. And I mean, he didn't bomb. He just wasn't doing it. I think he was trying too hard. You know, he had two women there that were watching. So I left halfway through, and I knew that would upset him. And then he just like tried in every way to get in touch with me after that. And he did. The owner or the booker of the Cellar, Esty, she called me and she was like, "Do you want me to give Rich Voss your number?" And I was like, no. And she goes, that's what I thought.
Oh my God, that's great. So how long did you guys date before you got engaged and got married?
Well, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. Mm-hmm. After we got married, I kept my apartment for 2 years. That'll just tell you where I was at. Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to jump into anything. No, we kind of just were sort of sexing it up every once in a while when we'd be in the same city. It wasn't really this like, you know, like, I don't know. I remember him one time being like, you've got to get rid of any other guy that you have. And then I did.
Before or after you were married?
This was after. No, that's hilarious.
See, I'm working on my stuff.
Yeah, then I let go of the apartment and we really hunkered down.
Right. Okay. So now tell me about what it's like for two comedians to be in the same house. Are you guys, I know you said he makes you laugh all the time, but are you guys practicing jokes on each other? Are you laughing all the time? What's that like?
Yeah, we do a lot of, is this funny? And then it's not good to do because we're very like judgmental of jokes. The good thing is if they're like, I'll think of it, I'll be like, he'll just say stuff in regular conversation that I'll be like, you got to do that in your act. You got to put that in your act. And then later he'll call me like, what was that joke you told me to put in my act?
Right.
So there's that kind of thing. But then sometimes we'll be like, is this funny? And you're just sort of dancing around this premise, trying to find the way in. And the other person gets tired of listening. And, you know, right. Like, no, that's not good. Stop right now. I don't want to hear the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. And then throughout your lives, you guys have obviously been exposed to a bunch of different comedians, celebrities, that kind of thing. What was that like all of a sudden knowing that you are part of this group? I mean, you are a famous comedian and you are hanging out with people like Anthony Bourdain and all sorts of other people. And I mean, it's just a testament to all the people you got in your documentary. I mean, it was everyone who's everybody. So what's that like to know you're part of that crew?
This is so interesting because, you know, when I got to New York, it was like the same people were the same people. It was like Dave Chappelle and Dave Attell and Louis C.K. And, you know, I don't know how. I just immediately started sort of hanging out with everyone. I mean, I was.
Is it a small community? So,
what's that?
Is it a small community of people that kind of have always been the same circle and just made it together?
I mean, I don't even know if those guys really hung out. I guess they did a bit, but it was more like you're just working at the same club. So you're in the same, and then, you know, they just moved up, you know, and it's like, they're still the top of the New York comedy scene, in a way. And it's interesting, but Yeah, I don't know. I was very starstruck by Anthony Bourdain. And you want to hear a funny story about Colin Quinn? Yeah. So I went for lunch with, so Anthony Bourdain just liked me and my comedy and stuff. And so then he was the one who published my book. And he was just a very, very supportive guy. And I wrote his stage shows for him and wrote a lot of stuff for him. And so we were having lunch and he was like very interested in comedy. In fact, he did it once at the, he said, you know, what's the difference between me just going up on stage, you know, doing these stage shows and being a real comedian? And I was like, well, you have to do it every night. You know, you have to really, you know, these guys love it so much. They do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And so he went to the Cellar one night. And I got him a spot there and he went on. I didn't go because I didn't want him to bomb and then me be there like, hey. apparently he did very well. So he was like obsessed with Colin Quinn and he was like, is he really like so funny? And I was like, yeah, he's great. He's like, you know, I would never say this to Colin, you know. I say to Colin, I'd say, I told him you were an asshole.
Right, right.
So I told Colin that Anthony Bourdain was a big fan. And then I guess Colin was on a show with him, maybe like Conan or something. And so Colin went to his dressing room and was like, you know, it's like me, the guy you love. And I guess Anthony Bourdain was just kind of like nonchalant about meeting him. Maybe he was trying to be cool. And so Colin called me right after and was like, were you fucking with me? Which I think would be such a funny thing to do to someone, like just right. Tell them some celebrity was like, love them.
Right. And then you show up and they're like, wait, who are you?
I even know who you are?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's great. So Anthony wrote the foreword for your book. Obviously, as you said, was a big fan of yours. What was that like when you heard that he died?
Oh God, just shocking. Yeah, because it was like, he was probably the, like out of every single person I know on the planet, he would be at the very last person that I would think would, take his own life. You know, that just really was mind boggling. Cause if you know him, he's very, it's like, you could see him getting depressed and getting angry and getting upset about things, but that he's also super smart and super even keel and that he could, you know, sort of talk himself out of it or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't seem, you know, so that was really hard. Very emotional. And yeah. He has a daughter and, you know, just very sad.
Very sad. Did you work with him on Parts Unknown?
I did. Rich and I did the New Jersey. He did New Jersey as an episode and we went and had pizza with him in New Jersey. And it's funny because Jim Gaffigan found out. Jim Gaffigan said, what is it called? Parts Known. Because it was New Jersey. You know, it's like all these people are going, you know, he's going to all these exotic places, but he did.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you actually, do you have like a moment that that you witnessed, or could you tell us something like, did he ever eat something relatable? Like, did you ever give him an Oreo for dessert or go to McDonald's with him or something? Or was he always eating some sort of giblet of chicken and whatever?
He literally never talked about food. Never.
Really?
No. And when I wrote stuff for his stage show, that's all. He just said, write anything about food, any jokes about food or sort of related to food. But he never discussed anything that I wrote with for him. Even he would just be like, these are great. Thank you. And that was it. He never, we went out for lunch a few times. And the one time we went for lunch, him and his agent and me, this was about the book. And you could see his back was to the kitchen door. And he honestly, he was there before us. He was there early and he had a drink at the bar. And then we moved to a table and he sat down and it was like, he didn't know, or he didn't care that people knew that he was there and liked that he was there. And people kept coming out of the kitchen and there was a lot, because I was sitting watching the whole thing behind him, you know. He never turned around. He never looked around. He just, you know, and I don't remember what he ordered that time. Maybe like the fish or something normal.
Right.
Right. You know, and he didn't know, he, like, people are like, the chefs are probably like, Anthony Bourdain is here.
Right. Do you think he realized he was such a big deal?
He had to know. He had to have known. He had to have known, but he never acted like it. He never, he was just like a normal, nice, like, guy. Like, in fact, he was just so cool. Like, I've always felt a little, like, I tried to kind of get away from him in a way because I was scared that I would say or do something that wasn't cool. You know what I mean? Like, because he was so nice and kind to me and gay, you know, he was getting me this book deal and he was like, I just didn't want to fuck it up.
You know? I was just going to say, you were just so, you were walking on eggshells. You didn't want to fuck it up.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was, and now I, that's like a big regret that I didn't just like, he liked me. I should have just been me and not cared. And
Right. But
I had such respect for him.
Yeah. I think a lot of people did. Okay. So I want to get to an important question for a comic. What makes somebody funny?
It's such a good question. Well, authenticity, I think, is a huge part of it. Even if you're not telling the truth on stage, like say, like a Mitch Hedberg used to just do sort of jokes, not autobiographical, but he had such an authenticity that it was like fun to watch him. It was funny. I don't know. That's like such a good question.
Well, I mean, like, can anyone learn how to do it? Can you train someone how to take their experiences or find something else that they want to, you know, have as their shtick kind of, and train them to do stand up? Or is it just kind of something that's innate, do you think?
Well, I think you could probably train someone to do stand up if you had enough time and they could go on stage enough. Mm-hmm. Although I know people have been doing it, they're, you know, 25 years and they're still not funny. So it's, you know, but it's like, it's this thing of like the way your brain, if you can match up, if you can align the way your brain thinks about something with the persona that the audience is seeing,
right,
then it's really much, much easier. So if you have like, if you're Louis C.K., it's easier for him to be funny now, not because he's famous and they're like, I'll just laugh at anybody who's famous. Mm. Because people won't laugh at it. They don't care if you're famous. I mean, maybe in the beginning, but at some point they're like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
but they know him. Or Bill Burr might be a better example. Like, they know that he's going to be mad about something, right? So it's easy to get on board right away with that. You're like, okay, here we go. This is what he does. This is so funny. You know, they know who he is and they know that's real and they know that's authentic to him. Whereas maybe in the beginning when he first started and he'd be angry, they'd be like, is he really angry? Like, does he really hate whatever? Or, you know, so that's why it's like harder in the beginning when you're trying, you know, finding your own voice, because it's hard. It's a hard thing to get the audience, especially in 3 to 5 minutes. Sometimes when you're starting out, that's all you get. And you have to make the audience see who you are.
Right.
And then everything else really is much easier, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think about, have you noticed that, you know, there are all these sort of actors or reality stars who have not done so well on their own platform and they've decided they're going to be stand-up comedians. It's kind of like these people that are becoming late in life lesbians or something. They're just out of the blue deciding, I'm going to get into comedy. Is that going to work for them? I mean, I've seen people announce that they're going to do that. I haven't ever really seen anyone go on tour.
Well, I think, I mean, all through my, even before, like, you know, TikTok and stuff, I've seen people who had some kind of fame then try to parlay it into stand up, you know. So it doesn't work very often, but I'll tell you something. Hannah Berner,
who I was gonna bring her up,
was on
Summer House or something.
Summer House, thank you. Yeah. She, you know, and I think I remember the first time I met her, I was like, here we go again, you know. But she's really funny, and I think it is because she's authentic. She's just who she is, you know, and you really get that. And it's funny. And she's not trying to be something. She just is what she is. And she's fine with it. So I think she's going to do really, really well.
She's an interesting one because she, you know, didn't do so well on her show. I mean, she created a lot of controversy. People were like calling for her to get kicked off the show. And, you know, you thought that was kind of end of her, and she's really taken off. And I think that's amazing. Yeah. She really created a name for herself and is doing well. So I commend her for that.
It can happen.
You're right. It can happen. So you brought up Louis C.K. I wanted to talk about cancel culture for a minute.
I switched it to Bill Burr.
Yeah, you did.
Why am I talking about Louis C.K.?
Yeah. So listen, I feel like as an outsider again, we've seen cancel culture come into play in the comedy world twice. Obviously, we saw it in during the Me Too movement with Louis C.K., with Aziz Ansari, with some other people. And that was obviously related to sexual harassment issues with women. To me, that, and I want to get your opinion on it, but that seems more like a man in power position as opposed to just in comedy, because that was just one arm of where all these guys were getting in trouble. I mean, do you think that had anything to do with the comic world, or you think it's just a man situation there?
Well, I mean, here's the thing is like, sometimes I think like there's overcorrection, but on the other side of things, it's like, it would be nice to go to work and not have to worry about somebody trying to fuck you. You know what I mean? It's like, okay. I mean, when I first started, that was like a huge part of like any interaction I had with a man, even if he was a club owner, you know, it was like, you had to kind of like weasel your way through this little uncomfortable part of things. I remember this club owner saying like, I got your headshot and I put it above my bed, you know, or on my ceiling or something. And everyone was laughing and I didn't even get it. I remember just being, what is that about? And then this other comedian, he goes, you're going to jerk off to it. And I was like,
oh my God. Yeah.
I know. And, you know, and I don't like, I like dirty jokes and I like sort of joking sexually to a certain degree and stuff. But I do think there is a thing with women that like, if you joke sexually, people think they can actually have sex with you. Right. So then you just see the grass is greener. If you're a guy, you can just go around and fuck around and have fun and say what you want, do what you want. And there is something that's like, kind of like where you yearn for that, you know, but, as far as like the Louis C.K. thing, I think his thing is like he was gross, you know, but his shit came out at a bad time for him.
Yeah.
Because that was like, because people have done much worse since. And it's like, it's almost like, well, that point in time is past.
Right. Exactly. And then I want to move to the next part of where I noticed cancel culture in comedy, which was, you know, obviously brought to light during the Will Smith slap, where, you know, Chris Rock was on stage making a joke, saying something he thought was going to resonate or be funny. And somebody was physically violent with him because they took it not as a joke. So then that became an issue. You know, you see like Dave Chappelle getting things thrown at him at the Hollywood Bowl, or, you know, then it became, when do you have to be sure you know what you're saying and people realize it's a joke or you're going to offend somebody and then get canceled for being offensive when you're comedians? Aren't you supposed to be able to say things and have people know that it's a joke? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's like a really tricky situation. Like I think, you know, it's weird because people do call you out when you're on stage for stuff. Sometimes they don't even finish hearing the joke. You're like, well, you know, sometimes there's irony involved. Sometimes you have to like give the comedian the, like, they're not going to say I'm joking right now. You know, you have to assume that they're joking because they're on stage in a comedy club. And, you know, sometimes I watch other comedians and I'm like, that's gross. Or they do some joke about somebody's mentally handicapped or something. You're like, that's kind of icky to me, but it's like, you know, they're doing what they want to do. I don't know. I just think like, we could all be a little more tolerant. I think comedians could also police themselves a little better. It's like, if you're really good at telling jokes, then you don't have to concentrate on this one part. But I think some comedians just like that. They like the idea of being canceled. They get a lot of juice out of that. They get more ticket sales out of that. So
that's interesting. So I mean, do you feel like you've ever had to pull back on what your sets used to be now because things are so different?
Yes. Yes. I think before you used to, like when you were on stage, people knew you were joking. So you could say things, you could really cross the line because they would assume that you're joking. It's not like everybody who laughed was like, whatever, anti whatever thing you're saying, you know. Yeah. They'd understand that you're doing a character. It's not even a character. You're just joking. You're just saying the wrong thing because it's funny. Yeah. And now you can't do that anymore. That's just not a style of comedy that really works very well. Yeah. And so I walk the line, but I don't really cross it that much anymore, you know?
Right.
Unless I'm at somewhere where I know that it's like going to be okay to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not worth it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not worth it for sure. Who do you think is really funny right now?
Well, my friend Annie Letterman is hilarious. So funny. She's got a solo podcast, and she's going to shoot a special soon. She's very, very funny. Mm-hmm. I like Beth Stelling. I think she's really funny. I don't know. Sherrod is so funny. I mean, there's just certain people that you like seeing come in to the club, and I like everybody that works at the stand. I like that community. I like those people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And what about your thoughts about people who are not necessarily in New York, like a Chelsea Handler or a Heather McDonald, or, you know, people that have become sort of pop culture icons more than, I mean, obviously they're stand-up comedians, but they're more invested in pop culture now too.
Right. Right. Well, I like them both. And, Heather makes me laugh really hard. She's had some jokes that still stick in my head from years ago. Mm. And I like it. I like so many different kinds of comedy, and I just like when people aren't really taking themselves that seriously. Like, that's my favorite kind of comedy, you know? Right. It's like when you're not trying to make a point too hard or anything, you know? Because I feel like now people are really like, trying to say something, and it's like sometimes it's like clunk clunk, you know. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like, do you feel like people need to get on stage and talk about things that are really heavy? And I mean, don't you think that makes it like less, you know, interesting, or people can take offense to those things if you're talking about race and, you know, LGBTQ stuff? And, you know, people get so sensitive based on their experience, right? It could be tough.
Right. But they're getting attention, so that's like, some people don't care how they get attention, just as long as they're getting attention. And that's why they go to those. And then I think other people think they're going to be like, you know, some kind of, you know, deep, deep comic that's going to, you know, like they're trying to achieve legend status by talking about abortion or something. It's like,
right.
We already have a Doug Stanhope. We're fine. We're good on that.
Yeah. Okay. So if somebody's listening that is thinking that they want to try it out and break into the world of stand-up, what would be some tips and tricks or suggestions from you?
Well, I would like think about the things that I want to talk about. I would Google a bunch of comedians that I like and see how they approach comedy and approach jokes, and see how your sense of humor would align or not align with theirs. And then I would just go on stage and try it a couple times and see. And the thing is that I wish I'd known this myself earlier, is like, it's not important, like, at all. Like, you think it's so important to have a good set or to have somebody think you're funny, or have, it's like one set is not gonna, it's you're really committing to a lifetime of doing this, you know? It's like,
right.
You're going to get better. You're going to have peaks. You're going to have valleys. When you're going to have a set that works, and you're never going to want to give it up. And then at some point you're going to be like, well, now I have to come up with new jokes, and then you're going to dip down, and then you're going to come up again. And, you know, hopefully.
Yeah. And is that the way that you sort of try out jokes, practice, see what works, to get a real set that then you could potentially use for like, Jimmy Fallon, or, you know, something like that? Like, how are you preparing?
Well, I used to do it like that. I used to think like, oh, this is good for TV, or I was always working on a set like, oh, here's my special. But, you know, now things move really fast. Mm-hmm. The, you know, like if you have a joke that's in the news, it's like get it, do the next six sets with it. And then you got to kind of put it away, you know?
Right.
It's like harder and harder to have stuff that lasts for a long time. So, you know, just keep writing and doing it and being, you know, as real and you as you can be, I guess, up there. Because if you think you're funny, there's a reason that you think you're funny. So even if like other people, like even if you tell people I'm going to do stand up and they're like, you're not funny. It's like, you know what it is inside of you that you think is funny. It's like, that's what you have to translate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm funny, but I would never do stand up. So
you are funny. You're very quick. You could do stand up.
Yeah.
You don't have to talk about.
Yes, probably. I don't know that anyone would think it's funny, but yeah, I think it's funny now. I can look back. I've had my share of trauma that makes it funny.
Yeah, you see, you could do it. You've had enough trauma.
Yeah. So, and what's to say that people aren't going to steal stuff? I've never understood how that works, where other comics aren't stealing from others or complaining that something's been stolen. Has that ever happened to you?
Oh yeah. People have stolen my jokes. I don't care that much. It's like, take them, use them, whatever. I don't care because I just go through, I just do new jokes. My whole thing is the thing that makes me happy is thinking of a new thought and getting it on stage and having it work and making people laugh with it. I know people get really, really mad about stealing jokes, but it's like some of it's parallel thought. And also some of it is so like, if it's, it's like, won't work for someone else. Do you know what I mean? Cause you're like, it's like that thing where this is your thought about your life. It shouldn't work for anyone else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So the last I heard, your book was in development, right? Is that still happening? What's going on with the writer's strike and your situation? Tell me about that.
So, well, even though it's Canada and they can work on it, they've put a pause on it because I'm in the guild and they don't want to, like, you know, they want to be supportive, which I think is great. Although it's a little frightening because we were just rolling along and we had to pause it, but hopefully the strike will end soon. I mean, I say to myself every day, two more weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's got to be really hard for the people that literally made their living doing that. Like, you're still doing stand-up.
So I mean, I feel really lucky because I have like a lot of different revenue streams because I make a lot of money writing. And then, so then when the strike happened, I just sort of pivoted and started just doing more stand-up, you know, and we have our podcast. So,
yeah. So tell people about your podcast. It's so funny. I mean, I think the two of you, both of you are very dry, right? So the two of you are so funny together and you just talk about basically how much you annoy each other. And it's like my favorite thing to listen to. The clips are just so good.
Thank you. It's called My Wife Hates Me. And we just took a little break because we moved and stuff. And now, you know, we've never taken a break. We have over 500 episodes. So we took a break this summer and I think like September 15th or something, September 12th, I don't know. We're coming back and we're going to, you know, My Wife Hates Me 2.0. And we said, we're not going to argue anymore.
Wow. God, new season. Okay.
We'll see.
It's all about the love story now. I can't wait to see that. All right. Tell people where they could find you doing stand-up.
Well, I'm at the stand a lot, but I have, I don't know. When does this come out?
The end of September.
The end of September. I'll be in Skankfest in Vegas last weekend in September. And then in October, I'm at Mohegan Sun. So I don't know. You can just go to my Instagram, Bonnie McFarlane, and my dates are there.
Okay, awesome. And if anyone wants to reach out to you to get advice, are you open to that? Do you read your DMs?
I do. Well, I don't read everything, but yeah, for the most part, I'll respond. I'll respond at least once. But you know, it's so funny because I've been married for so long. And then if somebody like, I mean, obviously if it's just a dude being like,
I think you're hot.
Yeah. Like I won't respond to that, but like, I don't know if they're sliding into my DMs or do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I'm just responding to people. And then I'm like, oh, was I Am I flirting? I don't know. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry.
Oh, wow. Well, someday on your podcast, maybe you guys should read your DMs and and have Rich see if he thinks that's flirting or not flirting. That'd be funny.
That's a good, yeah. We're not going to argue anymore, though. So we really can't do that.
Right. Oh, well, you can do it in a way that you don't argue. That would be even funnier.
Yeah.
So right. Be like, wow, you were flirting. Yes. That's awesome.
I doubt it.
Yeah. Okay. So my last question for you is where do you see yourself in the future that is a goal, something on your bucket list that you want to accomplish?
Well, I've been held up on this movie, but I was hired to write this movie that I'm going to direct if that we could come back from the strike. And so, I mean, that's all I think about is directing a movie. I just love the idea of that.
Wow. All right. Well, that's awesome. We have our fingers crossed for you. I'm so happy to have had this conversation with you, Bonnie. I hope everyone
sees you
In person, because you are just the funniest, and I wish you all the best.
I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Misunderstood.